Dear Mom, I know you've tried to protect me from who I am, and you've said my life before you adopted me doesn't matter, but it does matter. It matters because I still have visions of the place where I was born. I've heard all the whispers. I know what happened in that town where I was born. And I know you've tried to protect me from its horror for 19 years. Well, today I'm going back to that little abandoned town called Gatlin. Home to the truth. Love, Hannah.
Welcome to Percolated Media's Children of the Corn series, part of the Three Men in a Retrospective's look at the film adaptations of author Stephen King.
Give yourself. It's his will.
Join Garrett.
Don't underestimate the power of my vision.
Matt.
He speaks to me always, but today he is displeased.
And Adam.
Is this how they come to a complete stop in California?
As they find out who of the three of them really agrees with he who walks behind the rose.
He who walks behind the rose will decide your fate.
Will the three podcasters survive this trek through rows and rows of corn?
I got your eternal flame right here!
Find out next, courtesy of Percolated Media.
Come on, let's go!
Children of the Corn, Revelation, released October 9th, 2001, and this is directed by Guy Magar. All right, boys, Dimension Films, they wanted a little bit of a spark. This was, believe it or not, supposed to be the final Children of the Corn film. Dimension Films didn't really see any more juice coming out of this fruit, so they decided to turn to the director of Stepfather 3 and the writer of Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 4. Two series that I hope we never get to cover. Adam, I know you're a fan of Michael Ironside. Were you excited to see at least Michael Ironside, what he could do with a movie like this?
I was surprised to see that title. I was like, okay, sweet. Somebody I recognize. And that's as far as it went with my excitement.
That's as far as it went. Not even the name Michael Ironside could get you excited, huh?
Not when we're talking Children of the Corn. Not even numbers. Revelation.
All right, Matt, what about you? Were you excited to see what Ironside could do with this?
No, which is my default answer for almost everything with this series up till now.
Well, a couple things about this one. Number one, this is the first one to take place in the 2000s. It's released not even a month after 9/11. And this also is one that it has the name of a producer that we're going to see more in the next few weeks. His name is Joel Sasson. He worked on Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, and he was one of the Dimension go-tos. You know, he worked on the Hellraiser films. He worked on a series that I don't know if anybody remembers called Dracula 2000. Did a couple of those. And he is going to turn up as a writer on at least one more as well. So at least we're going to get some consistency. But other than that, boys, that's all I got. What do you say we kind of dive into this plot?
We've gotten consistency. It just hasn't been all that positive.
Yes.
Consistently bad. Well, you know what? There have been a couple sparks. I will say this. I think the last couple weeks, we haven't had too many positives. I believe that those movies just had nothing really going for them. I'm hoping in the next couple that we will. I know there's at least one more that I'm really looking forward to discussing for a specific scene. But all right, we start off. We're in a house as someone's having nightmares of burning buildings and bodies. She appears from a door screaming, "Where are you?" as the opening credits start. I'll give it this. This one has a different look to it, right, Matt?
Well, now that they're in the new millennium, they have to put all $10 they spent on this money on screen. Although, technically, yeah, this is a one. But it's funny, you look at the poster for this movie, and it looks like all the horror movies we were getting around that time. Like Jeepers Creepers, The Skeleton Key with, what's her name? Kate Hudson. All of them have this kind of look and generic sub tagline, the all new terror filled chapter. I mean, the scariest thing is that they made seven of these goddamn things.
Adam, what are you feeling from the start here?
Oof, worst credit look, worst font. I didn't think we can go much lower, but we're going to go much lower right off the bat. So, oof.
Really, you didn't like the red stocks against a black background?
This
you didn't like that?
Horrible. I'd rather somebody just... There's an episode of Futurama where Bender holds up a handwritten sign, future female lawyer. Like, do that. Just hold up a sign telling me what this is, because this looks like shit.
Garrett, we have a new co-host on this show. It's a comic book guy from The Simpsons. Worst titles ever.
We see a woman exit a cab as the cab driver wishes her luck and then drives away. She walks in the building in a white suit, by the way, which is not a good idea when you walk into a building like this. Now, this chick, her name's Claudette Mink. She's a Canadian actress. She did a few movies, notably Paycheck, which is going to be part of the Philip K. Dick retrospective that me and Matt have been threatening to do for years. And she was in an episode, a pretty notable episode of Smallville, too, actually. But she retired in 2013. She is a very uncharismatic lead. I don't really gravitate to her at all during this.
They have been calling it quits, honey. If I made Monkey Bone, I would have retired, too.
Oh, another horrible, horrible film. So we have some tense moments as the elevator moves up and the kids don't stop staring. And there's one thing about this movie, boys. We've noted a lot about pacing issues. I think of all of them, this one has the worst pacing issues, because if we see someone go into an elevator, we're not going to just cut to them on the top, on the floor they're going to. We're going to follow them all the way up. If they go in a house, we're not going to cut to them in the room. We're going to follow them as they walk all the way inside the room and explore and look. Like, this movie is very poorly paced.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it has to be just a hit, a running time, to be considered a feature film. I mean, shit, we watch not Dina Meyer take 10 minutes just to get to this apartment. And that's my distraction. The whole time I'm like, is that Dina Meyer? No, I know everything Dina Meyer's done because I'm, well, the court did not label me a stalker, but let's just say a fan. So I think we are getting a Starship Troopers reunion, but I'm like, everything in here takes forever. And it's because it's got to hit that running time.
Yeah, this is 82 minutes, and I'm pretty sure at least 10 of those minutes involve people going up elevators.
Yeah.
Even Tolkien would look at this thing and say, man, you're drawing shit out.
We see that this chick sees two brick walls in a hallway. She walks down the hallway to room 407, which has an eviction.
By the way, that thing with the brick wall, they stole that from Freddy's Dead, which is not the nightmare movie you want to be riffing on.
Well, Freddy's Dead didn't have exclusive rights to the brick wall. You can use brick walls anywhere.
Yeah, I think brick walls are under public domain. I'm pretty sure they were okay. Did Stephen King write a book about a wall that haunts people?
Not stay tuned.
I don't think so. She knocks on the door asking for her grandma before unlocking it and entering, and she walks this relatively clean apartment before sitting on the bed and picking up a picture of her and her grandma. Cut to the police station as a detective meets with Jamie to discuss what happened. She says she can't be with friends as she doesn't have any and that she's been to hospitals looking for her grandma. So she's come here to pretty much just look for her grandmother, and that's the mystery.
Garrett, I mean, Adam, I think I played this game in one of the Silent Hill franchise installments.
Yeah, I think of too is, yeah, if anything, it's at least a Silent Hill DLC.
Yeah, one DLC that has no patch update, doesn't load correctly, and takes all of 5 days to finish.
Now, did that Silent Hill game have an apartment building with corn stalks growing right by it?
I'm pretty sure one of the Silent Hill movies did. Which, by the way, apparently, like,
Jamie,
the building an apartment complex next to a cornfield, that's the equivalent of building a suburban house over an Indian burial ground with Children of the Corn, where if you build it next to any kind of agriculture, bad shit's gonna happen.
Jamie says she moved out of her house and into this dump before finding a Bible in her room, even though she's an atheist. We see Jamie in the room as, what the fuck is this being thrown at her window? I guess this is corn mixed with blood. I didn't really get a read on this. Matt, this kind of reminds me of that scene in Nightmare on Elm Street when stuff gets thrown at the window. At least we kind of know what that is. What the fuck is this shit?
I thought it was like unprocessed corn syrup.
Jamie walks outside and sees a girl playing hopscotch. Very Nightmare on Elm Street-ish, huh, man?
God damn, did Wes Craven ghost direct this? I know it wasn't dead yet, so that's why I said ghost direct this sense.
Yeah. Adam, you must have liked the Nightmare on Elm Street type imagery here.
I'm right? Offended when they decide that they're going to pull out, like, trick that have already been, at that point, buried in the ground by their franchises. This is just like, oh, fucking A. You got nothing to do here.
Jamie enters a convenience store. As she's grabbing groceries, she feels something looking at her. She's right as she spots the kids from the elevator, but the boy just wants to play House of the Dead, and she teaches them how. House of the Dead! We'll be getting to that probably if we ever get to the video game retrospective we've been threatening to do, but it was really funny to see this game in this movie, because I remember this game being very popular back.
Yeah, and the voice acting in the second game is almost as bad as the acting in this movie. They were at least being consistent. It's maybe a half step above the Uwe Boll movie in that department.
But if we think these are bad, wait till we get to Uwe Boll.
by the time we get to that, you're going to have to outlive me.
That's who I feel is ghost directing this film. I mean, I feel like Uwe Boll somehow was involved in this. Saw the video game, was like, oh, I got something I'd do in the future for more tax laundering.
Wasn't touching Uwe Boll. So Jamie asks the guy behind the counter, where are their parents? And he says that they don't say or buy anything before trying to convince her to just ignore them. She then asks this guy about her grandmother, but he says he doesn't know her. She walks outside into another little girl as she says, kill, and is given a quarter. I should try this, actually. This is fun.
Nowadays, they're all power cards, yeah. To this point of war. Not that arcades are even much of a thing anymore. The only reason they're around is because they serve alcohol at them, and they're made more for adults nowadays.
Yeah, Matt, you and I have gotten drunk at a couple of them together. Jamie then spots someone with a hat and cross dressed in black, and he's in the streets, which, of course, this is Michael Ironside. But he walks away. And this must have been part of the half day he spent working on this, and probably worked about as much as David Carradine did a couple of weeks ago.
Why is he dressed as the Undertaker?
I don't know. I didn't keep expecting that fucking theme to hit every time we see him on screen. So she goes back into the complex and sees written on chalk in the room, Jamie, go home. She knocks on this guy Jerry's door, and he answers while taking a bong hit. He says he doesn't remember agreeing to taking her grandma's messages. So we're going to get, in this apartment build, we're going to get pretty much every cliche you can get.
We got the kids, we got our kid games, we got a stoner. I mean, we're just checking boxes, but at the same time, nothing is happening. The only bright side is the timer keeps ticking, so I know I'm getting closer to the end.
Matt, what about these cliches? We're going to get the slut here in a little bit. We're hitting every spot, right?
I think everyone in this apartment complex is held here as purgatory and penance, which is why they all feel ripped from other franchises. I mean, they even gave her, like, the leather jacket to make her look more 90s-esque, even though this takes place in the 2000s. And, oh my god, for the record, not that most of these sequels were made for a lot of money. This one feels the cheapest by a pretty decent margin.
Yeah. Jamie's typing up an extension letter on her laptop as she hears kids playing right outside her door. She goes to explore and sees not a field of corn, but carrots and tomatoes, which have corn kernels inside.
Oh, it's, Adam, it's the tobacco field from The Simpsons. Oh, great, I got a field full of mutants.
She walks out as she hears laughter, as a man with a gun tells her to keep out, as someone in a wheelchair tells her to get the fuck out of the way. So, again, we're meeting people left and right here. Speaking of meeting people, Jamie then meets Tiffany as she's getting ready for work at the strip club. Now, this chick works, what, 12-hour days at a strip club? I don't know if I've ever heard of that. I dated a stripper years ago. I seem to remember her having normal shifts. Who works a 12-hour day at a strip club? I don't know.
Yeah, this is where it loses me with sense of credibility, is the stripper labor relations. This is when it just goes too far. Yes. You know, for all the shitting we've done on this series, and stay tuned, we're not done yet. If we're going to be this bad, at least give me my exposition while a stripper is getting dressed for work.
There you go. Checking that box as well.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Well, that does nothing for me, so I'm still going to be harsh.
Tiffany says she got her eviction notice a week ago, but she stopped paying rent months ago. She goes on to say that her parents died in a house fire a couple years ago. Tiffany then says that if Jamie needs anything, to let her know, as she's alone in this world too. So the stripper with a heart of gold.
Yeah, is Elizabeth Berkeley living in one of these rooms? I'm not talking about her character. I mean, is she actually living there?
You know what, man? I got to say, too, we're getting a close-up of her painting her nails and things here. This chick is photographs. There is a lot of male gazing going on here as we're looking at this. I was surprised at the amount that we have. Not surprising coming from Dimension. Jerry shows up at the door and asks her to join him on the roof. And this guy seems to be a bit odd, huh? He starts chomping on corn, which is littered with blood, and he hears the kids from earlier laughing. He asks where they came from as he joins them, and they throw him off the roof and into a field of corn.
Why? It doesn't deliver three letters. What, the letter Y, that's all I know for this entire fucking film. Why?
Because
why,
we haven't why, had a kill why? Yet, and we need to get a kill in. That's the only thing I can think of.
So we toss him off roof for no reason, then the kids fucking start teleporting like or Kurt Wagner here throughout the rest of this film. Okay.
I kind of have to, because the fact this is a Children of the Corn movie, the kids are the least important component of all these movies in this one. Like, they literally teleport in and out of the movie so much that you could call this anything else. Because I don't even think... Oh, wait. Well, they do mention it at one point. Because it's almost like Stephen King steps into every one of these movies and goes, hey, by the way, you need to include either the word Gatlin or He Who Walks Behind the Rose.
Yeah, Ironside says it in this. God, what a moment that is. Jamie shows up and she turns off the radio and turns around to see the kids on the roof. She tells them it's not safe up there and asks where they live, but they transport themselves to the stairs that lead out. She spots a kid in the field, as well as the priest once again, who decides to walk the railroad tracks. Jamie then goes to Jerry's place and knocks on his door to tell him that his steak is burning before walking out.
Yes, that was not a misquote. There's, for some reason, railroad tracks that are about 30 feet yes. from the front door. You walk out of this apartment complex through rows of corn onto the railroad tracks.
Yep. Okay. Sounds legit. Uh-huh.
Someone called the housing department.
There's a lot of things wrong with this complex.
The public works and town administration here who designed everything should be ashamed of themselves, because the landscaping and how where things are placed make no geographical sense for this area.
Jamie lays in bed and opens the Bible to see the name Harriet Markham. She also sees clippings of a tragedy and an excerpt highlighted. She also spots a bottle of pills before going to sleep.
God, I wish I had a bottle of pills before getting
she
play.
She has nightmares about her grandmother and the scene from earlier, which apparently ended with her getting run over by a train and corn stalks growing around her. And boy, these computerized corn stalks. The CGI is not very good. We fade to Jamie once again, thinking that she spots her grandmother before seeing maggots escape the mouth of a little girl. She goes to the bathroom mirror and takes some pills herself, which Adam wishes he did, as she hears the creaking of a door. We go back to the detective, who says her grandmother has an interesting history as she survived a fire set by a religious cult, and they killed themselves because they were scared they were going to be shut down. And boy, this detective, you talk about somebody who just kind of goes in and out of this story, and I guess it's supposed to be the love interest, but we don't really develop him that much.
The only developments in this movie are that apartment complex. That's it.
He asks if she's all right, as she thinks that she sees the kid from earlier in the office. He offers to give her a ride home. But Tiffany shows up, walks by the huge fire extinguisher, and she throws the corn from earlier off her door. She sets up a bath as we see her undress against a red screen. Again, more male gazing. She hears a noise and goes to investigate and sees that the corn has been destroyed. Meanwhile, the cop explains the weird coincidence of both her grandmother and her parents being in fires. We then cut to Tiffany lighting some candles and as she gets in the bath. And this shit kind of looked like Jennifer Lawrence to me. I don't know why. It just kind of gave that feel to me, like a low-rent Jennifer Lawrence. Which I would rather be than a low-rent Dina Meyer.
No, because I don't recommend watching House at the End of the Street.
What a horrible movie that was.
There's a reason why the anagram for that movie is hate.
Film. You know, we've argued over the Dina Meyer versus J-Law type of look for a woman for 30 years, and I don't think that's going to end anytime soon.
Everything in this movie is low-rent. Dina Meyer's shelf, just saying.
And... you know, one thing we've learned, Matt, watching these horror movies over the years is never shave your legs in a horror film. It never ends well.
Yeah, well, was this was like right before Cabin Fever.
Yeah, a couple years before.
That's where you're
like, get in this room. Like, one of these things is not like the other. You look at this entire apartment, you look at this room, and you're
it's really weirdly. What? Yeah. It's almost like they just had to redress the same room over and over. So she relaxes in the bath as we see the kid from earlier hovering by the tub. He says his mom is dead and Tiffany insists that he leave. He drops some corn kernels into the bath and she's attacked by corn husks in her tub. Another terrible death. This is awful.
This, at least, was so stupid I almost had to admire it.
Admire stupidity?
I'm like, well, at least I've never seen this before.
You get a bunch of kids going through using corn kernels to kill people. You got a pretty decent 30-minute episode of Tales from the Dark Side, but instead we get 80 minutes of this.
Pretty sure that was also a Jerry Springer episode in the 90s.
Well, we have 83 minutes of movie and about 30 seconds of this, which is a big problem. So the guy from next door, he's yelling at her to be quiet while calling her a whore and pounding on the wall, and she's dragged out of the room. Jamie reads the paper and sees that her grandmother was the one person to survive the fire. Preacher Abel is the same boy that she's been seeing, so she puts that together. Why make a Children of the Corn movie a mystery like this? And not even like a well-developed mystery. It's all over the place.
Well, it's the opposite of what the first one did. Where the first one removes the mystery entirely from the prologue, this one does the exact opposite, where it opens with really no sense of what's happening or the status quo, and then slowly starts to unravel. You'd think they would have mapped this out in the opposite perspective, because as it is, I don't give a shit about any of this.
We cut to the guy with the gun hearing screams. He goes to his door and aims his gun to many laughs from kids. He puts the silencer on and then grabs his shoulder. He sees some monster in the mirror and he grabs the gun. He shoots the mirror and more laughing occurs. Jamie says the children that died in that fire are back as a cult as they're walking by both the corn and a hand on the ground. The detective examines the apartment and sees what looks like blood on the wall, but it's actually Hershey's chocolate. Jamie says that the corn was hanging on the wall. He tells her that there's no indication of foul play despite the picture and the kids who are hanging around, though she's the only one who notices, well, her and the priest. She says that maybe her grandmother is back and abducted by this new generation of kids who are back as brainwashed and hypnotized. The detective tells her to maybe get a motel and then offers her to stay at his place. He then asks her out at 7, but she makes it 9 o'clock. So here we go. We have a date going on here. Again, we've talked about this a lot, but zero chemistry between these two, and this guy is like about as bland as it gets. He's in and out of the story so much that like he's just a non-existent entity in this film.
I mean, there's no reason to be there. Make Ironside that role, except they probably couldn't afford him for an extra 2 hours on set to film what would have been. Yeah, it's just so bad.
And by the way, for those huge Ironside fans out there, Michael Rosenbaum has some great Michael Ironside stories if you listen to Talkville. He didn't get along with Ironside that much. It's a wonderful listen if you go out of your way to listen to it.
Is he even on
Ironside? Yeah, he plays Lois Lane's father in that.
Oh, because I know he voiced
General Lane.
Yep.
Dark Side and all the animated stuff. Must be a big Superman fan, man. For the record, he's Superman in real life because he's beaten three
guys. Yeah, I know. He's had quite a life. So the detective walks out of the place and then drives off. The yelling neighbor is still at it until the kids get a hold of his wheelchair and push him off the ledge while still laughing. I gotta admit, I kind of chuckled at this.
Well, yeah, because this kind of reminded me of the second one where it's like really black humor.
Meanwhile, Jamie hears more whispers and looks out to see what looks like her grandma trolling in the corn. She runs out and hears more voices. The kids then see, well, who is this exactly that they see? It's really weird, this shot.
I don't know, because the camera's not in focus enough for me to be able to tell.
Jamie then goes to the convenience store and sees it's been thrashed with the owner's head in the milk cooler, and the kid in her grandma's hat once again appears. She chases her out and hears more laughter. She goes up to the elevator set up earlier with this red jacket. And again, we have to follow her all the way up.
Yeah, she stole Claire's jacket from Resident Evil.
She pounds on Jerry's door to no answer, and she keeps trying different doors before screaming if anyone is there. She enters her own apartment and is then visited by the guy with the gun, who tells Jamie that she's the last one there. He says that he's leaving and warns her to watch herself. He gets to the bottom and spots the kids in night vision. He can't seem to escape them as they're everywhere, and he ends up dying of a heart attack. What?
This is from one of
I was Child's just thinking Play that, movies. Matt. I was going to bring that up. Yeah, this is directly from Child's Play 3, actually, when Chucky's about to kill the police sergeant, and he just dies of a heart attack right there.
He's like, oh, yeah. You're fucking kidding me.
I can't wait to revisit those films.
I was going to say, this is the second time in 2 or 3 weeks that I've seen this happen, and I wasn't expecting it. Now, the show that I saw it on, it was for a reason. Here, I just think they ran out of money, and they were like, damn, we got to kill him, and we got 75 cents left. But, you know, for a moment, him walking around with the night vision goggles, I'm like, hey, they did something different here. I enjoyed this for about 2 minutes. As bad as this is, at least it's a cool shot in those goggles for a moment. In the middle of something going on, there's a heart attack. It's just like, that's how it's going to happen. Like, it makes sense for what's going on, but it's just like, what the shit?
You know, I gotta say, boys, even at 82 minutes, this fucking movie is a clock watcher. I see this heart attack happen, and I see there's like 40 minutes left. I'm like, what the fuck? Adam, you said you liked the night vision, like when he's being dragged out. I thought that, I actually thought that was kind of cool.
It was the one piece in here where I felt like they made an effort to put a cool shot in. Like, I do think that there is not an effort made in this film. I think that one, the director was like, hey, I can do something cool with this night vision shot. We don't see a lot, but I think that's the one point where they were like, let me do something, and it looked decent.
Jamie then hears a noise outside, so she walks in the hallway and sees some kids playing patty cake. She approaches them, promising that she's not going to hurt them before they laugh and walk away. The preacher then grabs Jamie from behind, and she shows him the articles from earlier. He asks where her parents are and offers her communion wine. He says he sees her as unfinished business, as her grandmother should have died in the fire, and her parents and her should never have been born. So this is like a Final Destination kind of thing, right, Matt?
Yeah, it looks like they cheated death. Yeah, except Tony Todd even was like, I'm not doing this bullshit.
Rest in peace, Tony Todd. He then mentions the name He Who Walks Behind the Rose, and he brings up what happened in Gatlin, and he says that his own grandmother died in that whole massacre as well. So this is how we're connecting it to the story. He's just going to bring it up in exposition. We're going to have Michael Ironside do this.
Yeah, it's the
as exactly.
You know, which I always hate. And more, how many times can this happen in one town before the government steps in and just nukes it, like, turn the living dead?
He tells her that her only chance of survival is for her to leave, as evil is out for her. But Jamie won't budge, as she's determined to make the cult who hurt her grandmother pay. She turns around and sees the girl behind her yell, "Kill!" Jamie then grabs a knife. She says that she thinks the girl knows the old woman who lives there, and the boy appears to say that he knows where she is. As she leaves, the girl sets the stove to be turned on. The detective, he comes in and sees the head from earlier, as well as a kid's tomahawk. He concludes that thing that did this was a sickle, and then he walks out.
Rather than just arrest exactly. him right there for probable murder, because that's quite a thing to walk into and not immediately be like, hey, what was your alibi?
Meanwhile, the kids take Jamie to the corn and walk her through it all the way to more kids who look like zombies.
Yeah, why are they now, like,
yeah,
totally possessed?
Like, now we have, like, possessed fucking corn kids.
Now, this could have worked if, actually, if you followed suit, not that this franchise has consistency outside of being largely dog shit, but if you, the end of the third one where people eat the corn and they get possessed, at least you would have had some semblance of continuity to make this make sense. Because the rules for this cult change as much as religion in and of itself, where it depends on who you talk to.
We hear music that sounds like X-Files music. It's playing, and then we hear what sounds like dripping water. Abel appears and says that her grandmother is there, where she belongs, and a kid talks to her in her grandmother's voice, telling her to run. Abel prevents her from escaping. She can't break the glass with a chair, and she tries turning the stove off, only for the kids to turn it right back on again. A kid screams, which makes Jamie cover her ears as she turns and sees Abel and the kids down the hall. She faces them in this distorted reality as Abel tells her to give herself to He Who Walks. Join us. So it's basically Darth Vader. She says, okay, but the wreaths are fire hazards. She throws one on her stove, and the wreath blows up, allowing her to escape. She gets in the elevator and walks out, only for the windows to blow, and He Who Walks to start appearing out of the ground. Boy, these digital corn stalks. Man, the sending is just ridiculous, and it looks really, really bad.
Yeah, it's funny. The further we advance in technology, the worse, from a visual standpoint, these movies look.
Yeah, I'm getting flashbacks to some of the absolute worst moments of some of the worst Nightmare on Elm Street films really late in that series, and I'm just like, oof, this, man, it looks so bad.
And it's funny you say that, even the bad Nightmare movies have pretty good effects work.
Yeah, I mean, they're able to utilize, it's a distorted reality, it's a dream. Some of the CG shots, I'm like, oh yeah, there we go.
Well, some of the rear screen projections, pretty bad, but this, there's also... For this portion, there's no imagination put into it. It's just, we're going to have her grandmother is still a child, which, you know, we've seen that a million times. You know, the swerve with the gas explosion. This was the first one where I actively paused it, got up, did something else, and came back and finished it.
It's a swerve, bro!
I'm pretty sure he was on a job at this time.
Jamie gets caught in the vines and is pulled down before a sickle appears and cuts her loose. This sickle, of course, belongs to Detective Lance Bass.
Yes,
that's the comparison I made. The stove finally blows up, and holy shit, 1984's original had better, more real-looking explosions than this one. This looks terrible. These two stand up and embrace, admiring the view of He Who Walks behind the rose being lifted into the sky. Bad digital fire as credits roll on Children of the Corn Revelation. Boys, anything to say on this ending?
Well, once again, these movies don't know how to use pyrotechnics whatsoever.
Yeah. I could have cheered when I realized that it was over and the credits started.
Boy, a lot of times we like to tease out our ratings like a stripper at a fucking dance club, but I think it's pretty clear where we score this. But for consistency's sake, scale of 1 to 10, what do we get? Children of the Corn Revelation. Adam, unleash, sir.
This movie exists for one reason, and that's to make sure that somebody kept the rights to Children of the Corn. Stephen King has been nice enough to say, hey, I don't think we needed all those Children of the Corn sequels. I don't think we needed any. Another corn sequels. Nothing makes sense in this film. The storyline is all over the place. The continuity is all over the place. They had so many ideas. There's train tracks. There's cornrows. There's an apartment. They had obviously access to a Kevin Smith type quick stop to film fucking two locations. Nothing in this film makes any sense. Not Dana Meyer and 15-minute Michael Ironside is what they decided to hang this movie on, and there's no reason to watch this. Even if you're a completionist, just doesn't do anything for the series. It doesn't really respect what came before or after, other than throwing in the name He Who Walks Behind the Rose and Gatlin. That's the only connection you're going to get. So I'm going to give it a 2 on 10 since it's got two mentions of what came before. Get the fuck out of this
2 film. Out of 10 from Mr. Bunch. My buddy Goudreau, what do you say, sir?
I don't know how much longer I would be a friend if these keep up. I have to ask myself, when we get to this, the dregs of a franchise, which we've hit some pretty, Garrett, we've hit some pretty low lows. I mean, some of those Friday the 13th movies, we've got a lot of really bad horror movies. So whenever we get those, I have to ask myself the question, could I recommend this to someone who is a mild fan of the genre or even the sub-genre of evil kids? And my answer is no, because I don't think this movie does anything well or even at the very least good. It's very non-threatening. You know, this movie's as loose as baggy jeans after New Year's Day. There's no scares to be had. The titular Children of the Corn are in and out of this movie so much that they might as well work for Harry Houdini, and it feels very disconnected outside of just espousing information about Gatlin and the stuff we've come to know from this franchise. And the worst offense of all, for an 82-minute movie, I felt like I was there for 2 days. This movie's corny and not in a good way. So I'm in lockstep with Adam. This is a 2 on 10 for me, and boy, it's had 3 big stinkers in a row. Actually, I would argue 4. So I'm kind of, you know, I'm ready to go out into the field myself and paint the agriculture with my own blood.
You know, normally, I like to take the more positive end of these films. I like to look at it in a more positive light than my two colleagues. But I have the same exact score written down as these two. And the reason is, and Matt, you hit on it for me, I can take bad horror. Matt and I have reviewed a ton of really, really bad horror. And I've said this before, but the biggest sin a horror film can be is boring. And there is no excuse for an 82-minute runtime for a film to be boring. But that's exactly what this movie is. As it was going on, I was checking the clock, and goddamn, I should not be doing that. Its pacing is terrible. Its acting is pretty bad. There's no real scares to be had here. Michael Ironside just kind of shows up for whatever was on the craft table that day and walks away. He's here to give 2 seconds of exposition. So don't watch it for him. Don't watch it for any of the consistencies here, because there is none. And yeah, this is the low point of this series. I knew it was going to get here. I knew that we were going to have some fun in the beginning, and then towards the middle, there's some stinkers, and we've had a couple in a row. So this is a 2 out of 10 for me as well. Yeah, skip this one altogether, even if you're a completionist. But here's the thing, boys. Next week's film, or the next film we're going to cover, is not a part of this series. The next film we're going to cover is actually a remake of the original film with quite a background to it. I'll get to the background next time. But boys, what are we feeling about a retelling of the first film? Adam, are you at least looking forward to discussing that film?
You know what? I was looking forward to it. I thought it would be something. Being that we were going to stop making sequels and we were just going to tell Children of the Corn, like, I do think there's room in here to start fresh. I do think there's room to tell a good horror story with it, maybe once or maybe as part of an anthology. So after this being so low, I thought rebooting and retelling and recontextualizing was proper fitting, and I thought they could do something with it.
At least mildly curious, you know, about as mild as Frank's hot sauce on the spice scale, because I think this premise is something you could do generationally. You know, evil kids, and more importantly, I don't think the original is a good movie, so that, by definition, is what I want in a remake. Remake the bad movies that didn't get it right, that had a germ of a good idea. And I was all excited that I saw, oh, this was a sci-fi original movie, and I said, well, I don't know how many of those I've seen. And then I looked at the list, I'm like, oh yeah, I saw Mankiewicz, and that was crap, and not a whole lot of these that I can recommend. So all my expectations kind of deflated like a balloon that you poke with a pin.
You know, I have, call me the color of optimism, but I saw, and we'll get into this when we discuss the next film, but I saw who was directing it, I saw what his intentions were with it, and I kind of got a little bit excited for it, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. But there's some pretty good things to get into in the next film, and I was looking forward to it. I was happy to kind of let these retellings, these sequels, whatever they are that Dimension was putting out here, I was glad to leave them behind and get to the original that we mentioned. A couple of the people in this podcast really didn't like that film. I kind of liked the first film, but I also thought I knew there were good places to go with it. So we'll get to that next week. But until next time, when we discuss Children of the Corn 2009, what hath the podcast commandeth? Thank you, boys.
We must sacrifice them both tonight.
Amos was satisfied. We need the woman. She'll bring the man to us.
No. He must be taken without her. We cannot remove her from this place. It is holy.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Why don't you put that in your gut and smoke it?
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Question not my judgment, Malachi. I am the giver of his word.
And keep coming back as the boys will continue going through the works of Stephen King in publication order.
Want you too, Malachi.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice. It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
You guys all belong in an asylum somewhere, loony bin. Where are your parents?
And if you like this review, please head over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast streamer of choice, where we have individual reviews such as Knock at the Cabin, The Black Phone, Megan, as well as additional blockbuster franchises like the Mad Max movies, Avatar, the Planet of the Apes franchise, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
You are a sinner. You are the fire of the corn. It will do you no good to curse me.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
You know not the laws. He speaks them only to me.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Assuming that it's ever stopped.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You know, you're gonna keep visiting Isaac. It's probably something you should know. It's a small town. People are gonna talk.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
But you've come back to us.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
It'll make us just like them.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
There ain't nothing out there, Mordecai, except a lot of corn. Stupid old corn.
See you around.
All right, Matt, what about you? Me and you covered RoboCop years ago. Were you at least excited to see what Ironside could do with this?
Michael Ironside's not in RoboCop.
He's not in RoboCop? No, he's not in RoboCop, is he? Have we ever covered Michael Ironside?
Well, you count his cameo in X-Men First Class.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Were you excited to see what Ironside could do with this?
No.
This is the end!